Great. Good afternoon. I'm a PhD student at Cornell University, and I'm going to talk to you today about the spatiotemporal variability of carbon dioxide concentrations in and emissions from a headwater stream in central New York. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge my advisor, Susan Rhea, and Todd Walter in biological and environmental engineering. Global atmospheric contributions of carbon dioxide from rivers and streams, known as carbon dioxide evasion, is estimated to be 1.8 petagrams of carbon per year. This is an order of magnitude greater than CO2 outgassed from volcanoes. Since rivers and streams are a significant component of the carbon cycle, it is important to understand the controls on terrestrial aquatic CO2 fluxes. Carbon can enter a stream from outside or allotogenous sources, from groundwater, precipitation, overland runoff, benthic exchange, or atmospheric CO2 exchange if the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is greater than that of the stream. In-stream carbon, or autochthonous sources, is taken up for energy from organisms and respired as carbon dioxide and converted to oxygen in photosynthesis. When CO2 reacts with water, it forms carbonic acid, which lowers pH. Fish have a very narrow pH range for survival, between 6.5 and 9. Crabs, snails, mussels, crayfish, they have a range between 7.5 and 10. So rapid changes in carbon dioxide, especially in poorly buffered systems, can impact fish and stream health. The goal of this work was to identify spatiotemporal patterns and environmental controls on CO2 in Fall Creek, a stream in the New York State Finger Lakes region, and determine implications for carbon dioxide emissions. So this here is the inside of a culvert, and you can see the stream passing through it. It's dark inside, there's going to be limited photosynthesis. So my hypothesis is that CO2 will accumulate inside the culvert, and so culvert outlets will actually have higher CO2 than culvert inlets. And similarly, stormwater and wastewater treatment outfalls will have higher CO2 than the ambient stream water. My second hypothesis is that upstream sites or headwaters, these first and second order stream trips, will have higher dissolved CO2 or pCO2 and greater diurnal variability than downstream locations, these higher order tributaries. For methods, I used an infrared gas analyzer that I protected with a gas permeable, water impermeable sleeve, and also I measured dissolved oxygen, pH, temperature, and conductance with a YSI water quality sonde, and I also measured air temperature, stream morphology, and stream flow. This is the Fall Creek watershed. It is 33,000 hectares, and nearly half of the land is agricultural. My 16 monitoring locations are shown here by these black spots, and I took discrete measurements at those sites between May and September 2015, and then I also conducted continuous measurements at these two sites with stars from July through October 2015. And this site at the top with the star, I'm going to refer to from now on as COMO. It's my furthest upstream sampling location, and this downstream site with the star I'm going to call FREEZE, and it is the closest site to the USGS stream gauge. This slide shows the diurnal variability of carbon dioxide and dissolved oxygen at the COMO site between July and August. This is from continuous measurements. The x-axis down here is hour of the day from 0 to 2400. The y-axis is dissolved carbon dioxide in parts per million by volume, and the secondary axis is dissolved oxygen in parts per million by volume. So this green curve right here represents the CO2, and the blue is dissolved oxygen. And you can see that the peak CO2 occurs first thing in the morning, and then as CO2 is taken up through photosynthesis and converted to oxygen, throughout the course of the day, you get a minimum in the afternoon, and you see the opposite trend with dissolved oxygen. And this difference between minimum and maximum carbon dioxide can be over 3,000 parts per million per day. And just to give you an idea, atmospheric CO2 is down here at 400 parts per million. So the streams are definitely supersaturated in carbon dioxide. And the photos down here are a time series, July through August, taken at the site. And pH shows a similar trend to that of dissolved oxygen, and it can vary by about half a pH unit over the course of a day. You see a similar trend here at freeze. This is still July through August, but we see this plateau. We don't see the clear peak that we see at Como, and I'm still looking into exactly the controls on this, but first off, the site is in a more shaded location than Como, so I'm hypothesizing that it will have to do with less photosynthetic active radiation getting through to that site, and it may also be due to discharge since it's a further downstream location. And CO2 varies here by about 1,400 parts per million throughout the course of a day. And pH also about half a pH unit. This is just to show the sites together. The darker lines are Como and the lighter lines are freeze. And the image on the bottom was taken in May, and it just shows the two sites. And the same goes for pH. The trend for fall, this is September through October at Como, and you see that the error bars here are much larger than they were in the summer. So you see more variability from day to day throughout the fall at this Como site as compared to the summer, and it could be due to senescence. And the CO2 varies by about 2,000 parts per million per day here. And actually pH doesn't vary quite as much as it did in the summer. And for freeze, we are seeing better peaks in more discrete peaks in dissolved oxygen and PCO2 during the fall. And the diurnal variability is about the same as it was in the summer. And pH is also about the same change. And just to give you an idea of what they look like next to each other, pH. All right, and I'd like to focus your attention now on the decrease in CO2 throughout the course of a day, the steep decline. And I'm able to fit a line through that decline that has a pretty good R squared value, 0.99 and 1 for the case of Como. And CO2 drops by about 6 parts per million per minute at the Como site throughout the course of the day, and 2.3 parts per million per minute throughout the course of the day at freeze. So I used that line to normalize my discrete measurements that I made throughout the summer, all my discrete measurements to noon, so that they were comparable from day to day. So this x-axis down here is Julian day, 130 is May, 310 is early November, and the green symbols are PCO2 in parts per million at Como. The white are PCO2 at freeze. The bars at the top are daily precipitation in millimeters per day. And the blue at the top is the water and air temperature. And if you look at the maxes for CO2, I'm hypothesizing that when you have still water, when there's not a lot of rain going on and the water is fairly calm, lower discharge, that CO2 builds up in the water, and then when a storm event comes, there's turbulent mixing, more reaeration, there's more exchange going on between the stream and the atmosphere. And so you'll get these peaks in carbon dioxide and then these declines when there's calmer conditions, and then they'll peak again. This is the spatial variability of PCO2 at the site. These are all my sampling locations now. This is the averages for all discrete measurements throughout the summer. And you see a big range there of 500 parts per million, which is just a bit above atmospheric, to an order of magnitude above atmospheric CO2 with these red sites right here. And The arrows represent the drainage flow paths that the water would take, and these sites drain agricultural and wetlands. This shows the difference in CO2 from a culvert outlet minus the culvert inlet and from an outfall minus the ambient stream. And anything above zero means that there was higher CO2 at the outlet or at the outfall as compared to the inlet or the stream. And for the most part, you can see that that is the case. These are the, this right here is the wastewater treatment plant outfall, and so that's outputting organic acids into the water, which are high in CO2, and you see that it's about 2,500 parts per million greater than the ambient stream water. And this stormwater outfall is only slightly higher in CO2 than the ambient stream water at about 25 parts per million, and I took the measurements down near the bottom, so there's likely a lot of degassing going on from the top to the bottom. And to give you an idea of what the culverts look like at the different locations, down here's a double culvert. These two were pretty still systems with a lot of vegetation. And on these events down here, where we actually, when I actually saw lower CO2 at the outlet compared to the inlet, they corresponded with storm events. And also this site right here, there wasn't much difference between inlet and outlet CO2. So that site, there was a grate covering the inlet, and there's lots of turbulent mixing and reaeration going on. And so it's a site that is definitely, can definitely be behind CO2 evasion. And to calculate CO2 evasion, you need to know the gas transfer velocity, which has been empirically shown to be a function of slope, discharge, and water column height, and also Henry's law constant for the solubility of carbon dioxide in water. And the bigger the difference between carbon dioxide and water and air, the greater the potential for the flux of CO2 to the atmosphere is too. So implications, summary and implications. CO2 was highly variable diurnally, day-to-day, and spatially. Possible environmental controls for carbon dioxide are precipitation, discharge, photosynthetically active radiation, temperature, morphology, and land cover, especially wetlands and agricultural. And for implications, direct and coupled monitoring of PCO2 and dissolved oxygen at a regional scale could help improve our understanding of the carbon footprint of inland waters and terrestrial aquatic linkages, and to quantify anthropogenic impacts on carbon reallocation and CO2 evasion from inland waters at the global scale, and make more better informed land management and infrastructure design decisions under future climate scenarios. With that, I'd like to acknowledge the NSF Iger in Cross-Scale Biogeochemistry and Climate, and my undergraduate research assistants, Cynthia and Adam, and thank you. So at the upstream sites, you're getting lower discharge, and you're getting this system that's better connected with its surrounding environment. And since there's slower water flowing there, you're getting more aquatic vegetation too. And so there's more of a chance for CO2 uptake, and also there could be some root respiration going on. But you also could have greater groundwater inputs, which are groundwater is extremely, possibly 2-3 orders of magnitude supersaturated in carbon dioxide. So that would be a big input on some of those upstream sites as well. Downstream, since the discharge is so high far downstream, you're not getting much vegetation growing there. And there's a lot of reaeration going on, so the CO2 is outgassing, and there's not a lot of time for heterotrophic respiration to build up in the water in those locations. Excuse me?
Did you ever measure the piston velocity?
The exchange coefficient? Oh, I have not measured that directly yet.